out in the Hollywood District, Velo Cult. We're going to go out with a little more Brenna Sahatchian. This has been Paul Rowland with Wednesday Talk Radio. Thank you so much, and thank you, Ross, our wonderful engineer.
Thank you.
An echo of your own. It is to work and have such pay. It just needs life from day to day. In your limbs as in a cell. For the tyrants used to dwell. And to be for him made. Loom and plow and sword and spade. With or without your own will bent. To their defense and nourishment.
And good morning. It is just a few seconds before 9 a.m. here on KBOO Portland. KBOO has offered a Bill of the Month membership since the very beginning of the station. Now you can be a sustaining member without any of the paperwork. We here at KBOO Community Radio encourage everyone who donates to become a monthly donor. Our members that give us monthly provide the most secure and stable funding for the station. It's easy and secure. You can set up your monthly donation through your checking account. We can also set up your membership with a debit or credit card. Monthly giving helps us cut down on the number of membership drive days we air annually. Also, monthly members are automatically entered into all of our sweepstakes drawings. So go to kboo.fm/give today to become a sustaining member online or call us at 503-231-8032. And thank you.
What happens when Oz and Wonderland collide in a twisted brain of a mad composer? A freaking musical, of course. KBOO is proud to present Nick T. Devlin's new musical, Alice Trippin' Sixes. It's a strange and unusual music odyssey. Flying monkeys, scarecrows, jokers, and even midday tokers. Oh, this ain't your normal musical, man. It's a far-out psychedelic trip into the mind of the mad. This is going to be one wild and crazy musical event. Alice Trippin' Sixes, Thursday, March 31st at 10 p.m. on your community radio station, KBOO Portland.
The bitter city of time. Her voice into sugar water.
Kristen Yount for Political Perspectives. Today I am going to ask the listeners out there to think about the upcoming EPA project. Actually, the EPA project, the Superfund site in the Portland Harbor on the Willamette River, has been a site since 2000. It was put on the national priorities list in the year 2000, and it has been moving forward as Superfund projects often do. And it's been 16 years, and finally the EPA is ready to approve a plan to begin construction on the cleanup, which will happen in November or December of this year. For every dollar that is spent, for every dollar that is budgeted, whether it be $1.6 million or $2.4 million, billion dollars, every one of those dollars will be represented in jobs and economic opportunity for the area. So you have to understand that there'll be dredging, there'll be treating, there'll be some capping and overlaying of the riverbed and on the shores. And it takes humans, that means man hours, woman hours, and human hours of actually paid labor, lots of it. So this is going to mean jobs. And that's just one thing that I wanted to bring out of this. I've been attending a lot of public meetings put on by the EPA, put on the Portland Harbor Citizen Advisory Group, and I've been reading a lot online. I've been doing a lot of research. And I always hear people say that they don't have faith in the EPA, that the EPA has been dragging its feet, and all of that. And I do think that some of it's easy to point at the powers that be and say these people don't want to pay for the cleanup. And before I get too far off track, I wanted to let you know that I have somebody on the line. And the president, I think the president of the Portland Harbor Citizen Advisory Group, Jim Robinson. Hello, Jim. Are you there? Well, maybe we'll try again. But yeah, so whenever an EPA Superfund site is found, they set into motion a community advisory group, and it is a citizen advisory group, and it is comprised of volunteers who will advise the EPA. And I do think it's part of their job to organize in the community. And the Portland Harbor Citizen Action Group has done a really good job of organizing in the city. But if you've never heard of them, then it's high time that you did, because the deal is the EPA is going to make a decision about what plan they want to move forward with. And hey, are you there, Jim?
Yeah, this is Jim. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Okay, great.
So I said a little bit about who you are, but why don't you introduce yourself for our listeners?
Okay, well, I'm Jim Robinson, chair of the Portland Harbor Community Advisory Group, which we're the citizen group of all volunteers. Just we've been watching the process for quite a while now and being involved with giving feedback to the EPA and also to the Lower Willamette group, who've been the industry group, and to DEQ about what needs to be done in the cleanup and what we would want to see from a community's perspective. And as community members, we're trying to make sure that we get heard for having a cleanup that will be a good, effective cleanup where we'll be able to enjoy a clean river and clean fish and actually have some life along the river.
So how long have you been serving on the CAG?
Well, I first participated before it actually organized, and then when the CAG organized, I wasn't able to make the first few meetings of the CAG for the first year or so. then I got involved and again, and that was about 2002.
Wow. So just to reiterate, these are people who have spent vast amounts of their time over the past 14 to 16 years, some have, to make sure that the citizens' voice are heard with regard to the cleanup and to do some community organizing. What other types of community organizing has the Portland Harbor Citizen Advisory Group done?
Well, we've held some events at Cathedral Park that were kind of super fun day fairs a river fest kind of activity to try to have people come down and learn more about what's going on with the process. We've had some events at various communities around in North Portland. We've tried to do some in other locations, but mostly in North Portland. And those have been forums to bring people in to talk about what's going on with the Willamette River and to learn about where the Superfund process is. And we have some more forums coming up. There's one on April 26th that'll be good to have people come to, and one on March, actually,
it's the 29th at
March 29th.
It's at a church, all of this stuff. Okay, so all of this stuff will be on the webpage at kboo.fm/political perspectives. I already have started writing up stuff about this program, and I have a bunch of notes on there, and I'm linking everything up so that people can look for themselves. I'm going to leave a nice trail of resources that people can find. And also, I found out that if you're interested in reading up on any of the technical documents that the EPA has put out regarding this site, and these are feasibility statements, and I want to talk about feasibility statements, but there's all these technical documents on file, and there's a repository at the St. John's Library. So if you live in St. John's, or you want to go to St. John's and just simply ask the librarian to that you say that you want to see the technical documents, and they're there, and you can peruse them and educate yourself.
And a lot of that material is available online as well. Yeah, there's on the Portland Harbor CAG website, which is portlandharborcag.info, just Portland, HARBORCAG.info. And that also links to the EPA website, which the EPA website is a little long to give over the radio, but you can link to the EPA website or even just do a search for EPA Portland Harbor Superfund, and you should be able to find it. The EPA website has a lot of the documents online, and not everything is available online because some of these documents are pretty big and would be pretty hefty to try to download. So that's why there's the depository at the St. John's Library as well.
So I wrote up just a quick overview of the history of the EPA and Superfund as it is now. The Federal Water Pollution Control Act of 1948 was amended in 1972 and was known as the first Clean Water Act. It created a regulation standard for waste discharges into waterways and contaminants in surface waters. It gave the EPA the authority to implement controls, gave grants to develop better sewer systems, and used to fund construction. It provided funding to states to work on state-led water infrastructure improvements. And later in the 70s, the EPA was working more with state relationships, so funding state projects more than working on federal projects. And then there was a lot of congressional hearings both sides, in the Senate and the House, in the 80s. In the late 70s, the 1976, the Resource Conservation Recovery Act, or the RCRA, was established, and it established controls over illegal dumping. It meant to knock off generations of waste and its elimination into our water systems. And then there was the Toxic Substances Act, which also put controls in place. Basically, in the United States, there was a huge... I mean, we had rivers catching on fire. There was just a big movement to clean things up. There was a chemical waste facility that caught on fire in New Jersey, and it blew up so violently that big barrels full of toxic stuff was flying in the air, way in the air, like a missile. Five people died, 35 people were injured. And then I'm sure if you haven't heard of the Love Canal in upstate New York, that community suffered miscarriages, birth defects, and death. Like the town died, basically. I don't know the exact statistics, but if you don't know, and it's because of just random dumping, kind of cowboy independent truckers would just go out and dump wherever. The generation of the EPA was to put controls in place.
Remember, a lot of this is not just because of random dumping. It's because of a business decision by a business somewhere that was doing something generating toxic waste that decided that they would dispose of their material in the public commons. They would dump it in the river to get rid of it, or they would dump it in a lake or bury it somewhere. Oftentimes, when Superfund issues come up, it's because the company that was producing the product that resulted in this waste decided to simply bury the material on their property, and then that material, because it was buried on the property, started leaching out into other areas and off, into the groundwater and going down other places. And so, they made a company decision that was how they were going to handle the waste, because there wasn't, at the time, usually there wasn't good oversight of what was done with these materials. Now we're dealing with the result of a lot of that. Another factor is that there are wastes that weren't simply buried somewhere, but there are wastes that simply got out into the system because they were materials that would be used and then would wash away in the rain. They would just wash down into the storm drains, wash out into the river, and that's where we get like PCBs. PCBs have become a huge problem. That was manufactured on a large scale up until the 1970s, early 1970s, when production was banned. But PCBs were so widely used in systems all across the country that they've become just widespread everywhere. And it's not because of a decision to, be a rogue and dump it somewhere. And it wasn't because of a decision to bury it somewhere. It was because it was just incorporated into so many products in so many places that it all leached out into the systems, and it got into the water systems, got into the rivers, got into the groundwater, and got into the soils that are all over the country, so that this chemical, which is a very long-lasting chemical, is a major problem.
Yeah, it doesn't break down into various parts. It just gets smaller and smaller and more ingestible.
One thing to remember about PCBs is that it was designed in order to protect electrical equipment from water damage, because PCBs are what's called hydrophobic. It's resistant to water. And so it was, for the purpose that it was developed for, it did its job well. It actually protected the equipment from water damage. But that means that it also does not break down very well, and it does not break down in the environment on its own, and it gets into other systems, and then it causes damage within marine life, within animal life, and human life. And that is something that was not properly considered when it was manufactured. And of course, now we know that the manufacturer of PCBs, Monsanto, realized fairly early on that there were problems that it would cause, but they kept manufacturing it.
Right. So, we'll finish up with, say, I'll just finish what I was saying with the EPA and the history, the basic history of, I know where you're going with that, but the EPA does point to the beginning of the social justice movement in 1982, officially started when a landfill protest in Warren County, North Carolina, brought to light the fact that toxic landfills happen where economically disadvantaged people live. And this is relevant to what we're talking about with Portland Harbor Superfund site, because food security issues, right? There's a lot of people who are subsistence fishing on the river. People use the river in that 11-mile stretch for food, and it's been told time and time again that the resident fish in the Willamette River are not safe to eat. And I don't want to go into that because that's the whole, that's drill, but suffice it to say that the fish aren't safe to eat. And so to bring the fish back and to bring, the fish in the river are a commons, and we should be able to use them. We cannot use them. We cannot enjoy them the way they're meant to be enjoyed. And it's because of the PCBs and, the fact that they are so easily absorbed into fish. And so it's really important that it stops. So I know the CAG is really excited about this decision made by the city of Portland, and I'll let you say it and you can talk about it.
Yeah, well, the city has, along with several other cities, especially on the West Coast, has decided to sue Monsanto over the damages caused by pollution from PCBs. And it'll be good to see when the city is able to actually recover damages from Monsanto on that, because that helps to pay for a lot of these costs that the city has already put out for the Superfund cleanup. And the city made a decision early on in the process to really step forward and be an actor in making sure the cleanup happens and paying for a lot of the costs of the Superfund, the feasibility study, and the whole process of getting to where we are now. The city itself never manufactured these chemicals and was never the user and producer of these chemicals to put them out in the river. And so, in our view, the city does not have liability for this cleanup. But the city, because the city owns a lot of the drainage, a lot of the storm drains and sewer systems that carried material to the river, the city feels a certain level of responsibility to help making sure that it cleans up. And of course, the city also is trying to act on behalf of the citizens of the city in order to clean up the river. So the city put out a lot of money that we really hope they're able to recover, so that us as ratepayers and taxpayers in the city can be repaid for money that was already paid out by the city. And it'll be good to see that happen. But the main point is making sure that the polluters who actually produced this pollution that's in the river are the ones that are held accountable and pay for cleaning it up.
So that's good, because the city of Portland has come forward and they are working to get the river into compliance of the Clean Water Act. At the end of the day, the Clean Water Act exists. It's a measure of a clean waterway, and the goal of the Superfund and the ultimate goal of the EPA is to get that section of the Willamette River up to clean water standards. And it's very clear. I think what I really wanted to talk about this hour, I really wanted people to call in with their questions and concerns about the EPA Superfund site at the Portland Harbor. Because I do think that there's a lot of misinformation. I think there are a lot of myths, and I think that people have and hold a lot of disinterest in it. And I just really want to take this time to clear up any myths or any concerns that people might have. So I do want you to call mm-hmm. in, and the number is 503-231-8187. 8187, that sounds right. So if you have a question or a comment, Jim is very knowledgeable. I've been studying this for years, not as intensely as others, but I feel like I can work my way around some things. It's awesome. The city's suing Monsanto. Everybody should be so excited about that. I don't know how far along they are in the process. It is an election year and all. And I'm not suggesting that the city would ever say something and then not do it. But if you are behind this and you want to support this decision, I would suggest that you let your city officials know that this is something that you support and that you want to see happen. And from what I understand, the lawsuit is on a contingency basis, meaning it's not going to cost a lot of city payer money or any
right.
any city payer money to go after Monsanto, because that was my big, oh, great. I just also want to bring to light, so there's 142 possible responsible parties, and they were told years ago that they had a hand in the pollution that exists in the harbor, and they've been served. They've been told. A number of them came forward. They formed the Lower Willamette Group. The Lower Willamette Group was charged with doing a feasibility study, and the feasibility study that they created, it takes a certain amount of time to search and discover 11 river miles. Some of the places in the river are quite deep. And so they made these feasibility studies, and time and time again, they weren't adequate. They weren't done to the completion of... Oh, we have a caller. Okay. So let me just finish this thought. So a couple of times the Lower Willamette Group was sent back. The EPA rejected their study, and they had to go back to the drawing board, and they were actually fined in 2013 $125,000 for not complying with the EPA standards, and they had to go back and start all over again. So if people think that it's the EPA's fault because they're dragging their feet or they're taking too long, then you should really... Check it, because the fact is the people that are responsible for paying for the feasibility studies and operating the feasibility studies were the ones that, in my opinion, were dragging their feet.
Let me just say, it's, mm-hmm. it's not that they had to start all over again. It's that usually what would happen is they would have a lot of material there, and the EPA would say, you know, you did not adequately cover this section, or you did not adequately review this, or this didn't seem accurate in how you did this. And so they would have to redo a particular section or add to it or add additional material.
Oh, good.
So sometimes it was, I would say sometimes it was, it may have been as simple as just not understanding exactly what the EPA needed in order to get to a decision. But I think sometimes it was perhaps an intentional oversight of just not including something that they didn't really want to include to begin with, and were hoping the EPA would not say include it.
So, yeah, so the EPA could have levied $1 million toward a fine toward the Lower Willamette Group, but instead it was $125,000 because they didn't want, you know, they wanted to show them that they meant business, but they didn't want to undermine the process. Okay, so I have a caller on the line. Hey, Johnny, what's up?
Hi.
Hi.
Okay, cool. You are there. So I heard you speak of the Superfund site, that the site will create jobs and opportunities for folks to be employed. My question is about specifically about the types of jobs and the availability of the employment and the work. I am currently unemployed, and so, of course, this interested me, and I am highly proactive in all environmental facets. And so I'm curious if there will be opportunities for the general public, or if you have to have special training, or if there are groups that you can apply to be trained, and things of that nature.
Okay, well, I'm glad you asked that. It's there. I think they will be largely construction jobs. One of the things that the EPA does is if of these potentially responsible parties, if say there's a company that operates barges and they are one of the PRPs and they have a role to play in the remediation, they can either pay to have, they can either come up with money to pay to have it done and contracted out, or they can provide the services and help with the cleanup themselves. And so this 11-mile stretch of river from the Broadway Bridge to the confluence of the Columbia has many different stages. So in some stages, they'll be capping it, capping the sediment. In other places, they'll be dredging. And so there are lots of jobs associated with construction sites. Does that answer your question?
Partially,
I can add to that.
Okay.
There will be, as we move forward into the actual phase of active cleanup work, the EPA will have some kind of job fair sessions. There'll be various things that will come up to encourage local hiring of workers for some of the work being done along the river. And so it'll be important to watch when EPA makes announcements about what's coming up. And if you're not on their email list, you can go to the EPA website and request to be on the email announcement list for the Northwest region and for the Portland Harbor Superfund in particular. And that won't be happening right away. It won't be anytime soon, but it might probably be in the next couple of years. There may be some fairs or some kind of information sessions that will be held about that. And so that'll be good to watch for. And the kinds of jobs that will come up will be, as Kristen mentioned, there'll be a lot of the construction work job in doing the cleanup. There will also be other activity happening. There will be some of the additional work happening along the river for restoration work. And so that, again, is often it's construction related, but some of it is planting native plants and areas that will be restored. So there might be some of those that become available as various things happen along the river. Those won't necessarily come out of the EPA information sessions, but there hopefully be information about that. Now, who gets hired for the jobs will depend a lot on who the contractors are that are hired to do various projects. It's possible that for a work along one section of the river, the party responsible for the cleanup would hire a contractor out of Seattle that would bring all their own employees down to Portland to do the work and then go back to Seattle. But part of the what we encourage as a community group is we encourage the EPA to have certain requirements that there be local hiring as well. And so hopefully whoever the contractor is for doing work along the section of the river would be required to hire some people from the local workforce in order to get the work done.
And in addition to that, I wanted to point out that there is a list of the possible responsible parties, and I actually have the list of their contact information, and I'll upload it to the website. But I really want to say, or maybe ask you, Jim, I have this idea that if people want to put pressure on these companies that are many of them are our hometown company with addresses in Portland, in St. Helens, and not all of them, but many on Front Avenue, the BPA, let's see, Union Pacific Railroad, Union Carbide, I guess those are more national, but Tube Forgings of America and Triangle Park LLC.
Let me just cut in a little bit that there's a long list of companies that were sent the questionnaires from EPA. That doesn't necessarily mean that they all have responsibility in the cleanup. Some of them that were sent the questionnaires were just, they were sent it because they bought a piece of property that was near the river or they did something that EPA cast a big net to try to capture all of the names of potentially responsible parties. And that's the potentially there is that some of them are not actually responsible for anything. There are also quite a few who are responsible for just very small pieces. And so they may have had an operation right along the river that generated a small amount of contaminant that then they have responsibility for, but they could very well come to a settlement that says, okay, we're paying $50,000 for our piece of responsibility, which was very small, and then we're done. So there'll be probably a good number of those.
Right.
And then you get to the ones for the major responsible parties, and those are ones that really need to be focused on to make sure that everything is done well. And so those big ones, a lot of the ones that have large portions of the responsibility are big national corporations because they have operations all over the country, and they have they had operations here, or they have operations here, they have land here that was contaminated that then they have responsibility for. And so it's important to remember that distinction, that there are, among this big long list of potentially responsible parties, there are some of them that don't have responsibility and some of them that have very small responsibility.
Well, the point I was trying to make is that there are, if you look at the list, sometimes there are names that come up more than once. And I just want to let people know that the list is available. And even if it turns out that a company you're looking at or your company you're thinking about reaching out to doesn't have a large part to play, I think that, community involvement and reaching out to these companies and letting them know that you're on to them, or thank them for their participation, or however you want to go about it. I just think the list is there, and the list is there for people to peruse. And there's a reason why they make it public, and there's a reason why it's there. And Even if, you know, you can, I guess, you know, you could try to write a letter to Northwest Natural and ask them, you know, hey, we know that you're going to be contracting a lot of help over the next 10, 15, 20 years to clean up the river. And we really want you to hire locally. I mean, I just think that however, whatever level your activism is, this information is here. And, I'm just saying there's, you know, just have eyes on it, even though you're right. You know, some of these people have very little responsibility. That being said, you know, in a $2.4 billion project, a small responsibility of like a $500,000 project is still a $500,000 project. And, yeah. And face it, you know, customer relations, why not? You know, why not be that company along the river that decides to, instead of lawyering up and fighting it all the way, why not listen to the people that are living in your community and trying to make it better and to move toward a place where they can eat the fish out of the river and be a responsible company? Give them the opportunity to take responsibility for this rather than calling the lawyer.
I'd say Northwest Natural is probably a good example, because Northwest Natural does have, and they will certainly have a large portion of responsibility for the cleanup, because they had a lot of activity along the river that generated quite a bit of pollutant that went into the river. Northwest Natural is also a locally controlled utility, and so they do feel a certain responsibility to helping get a clean river and to also hiring local. And so that's one that they're actually more likely than some of the others to make sure that they hire local.
Awesome.
So it's a good example to look at. And there's some things that they do well and some things that they really need to be encouraged more on.
Encouraged. Okay, we have Laura on the line. Hi, Laura.
Hi, good morning. Good morning, Jim.
Hi, Laura.
I'm a volunteer in St. John's, and I've done some work with the community advisory group, the CAG group, one of which was the Willamette Speaks Oral History Project, which a sample of which you can find on YouTube, which was a way of collecting river stories and connecting people to the river so that they would care about the river. Again, Kristen, getting to your point of why should we care about the river, it's a life source for us and will be more so as we move into the era of climate change. And PCBs, as Jim knows, this is one of my points. PCBs don't just stay in one place. They bioaccumulate in fish, sure, and you don't want to eat those, but they also oxidize and end up in the air. So, you know, everything's connected. Nothing stays in one place. So it's really important that we become involved, and it's a long process. What, 50 years? Jim can correct me on this. So it's a 50-year process, and we all need to become good stewards of this cleanup, because as administrations change,
right,
with climate change, things happen. We need to be on the ground, and we need to be involved. And I just wanted to say one more thing about the businesses. I think your idea of connecting with them is really, it's really important, because they need to be accountable and they need to know that we're watching them and we're working with them. It's definitely a collaboration.
Yes.
And they're here because we basically on different levels allow them to be here. And it came up, I think, at the League of Women Voters symposium on the cleanup, where actually a green harbor with green business would in the long run be more profitable. I remember Bob Salinger of Audubon saying that. So we need to encourage them. We definitely need to know, let them know that we're here and let them know what we want. And so that's my bit for today.
Thank you, Laura. Thanks. Next up, we have Eddie on the line. Oh, Eddie's gone. Is there somebody else? Oh, okay, well, you can call in with your question or your comment. Laura, thank you so much for calling and for reifying the fact that, you know, there's things happen, you know, people make mistakes, you know, when there was no rule to break, you know, people did what they did, and, you know, there's no shame, there's no judgment, you know, we just need to move forward and hope that people not just hope that people take responsibility, but also bear in mind that the EPA has controls in place and enforcement techniques to make people, make entities comply with what is going on. So,
And it's important to make sure that we have that enforcement occurring, and that when an agency that is doing enforcement of laws that protect us from damage, that that agency gets support from the people of doing that enforcement.
Yes.
And, you know, one I want to mention one thing that happened several years ago, a number of years ago, that kind of highlighted to me that the importance of showing some strong enforcement. In December of 2008, or leading up to December of 2008, well, actually, I'll say, yeah, it was in December of 2008, Schnitzer Industries, Schnitzer Steel, on the Willamette River, announced that they were going to put a major investment into cleaning up the stormwater runoff from their property into the Willamette River. And this was a huge investment that they announced they're making to do this cleanup. Now, what drove them to do that cleanup was a letter from the Northwest Environmental Law Center saying that they had an intent to sue, and that they were giving them notice that they would be suing over the damages that Schnitzer was causing to the Willamette River. And this lawsuit, as it was outlined in the letter of intent to sue, was that Schnitzer would be liable for damages that would accumulate on a daily basis if they didn't clean up and stop this damage to the river. Well, that lawsuit really triggered it to make sure that Schnitzer then moved and did the cleanup. But a couple other things happened at the same time that I think made Schnitzer recognize that they had to act. One was that Barack Obama was elected president, and so he was going to be appointing a new head of the EPA when he came into office that would be, as far as anybody could tell, would be much stronger on enforcement of environmental laws than the previous administration had been. Also, at the same time, John Kroger was elected Oregon Attorney General, and he made it very clear that he was going to enforce, he was going to prosecute against companies who committed environmental crimes, and that he was going to step that up for Oregon, and he in fact did.
Yeah.
So Schnitzer was looking at the fact that they had this intent to sue from the Northwest Environmental lawsuit. They had very likely much more enforcement coming into place at both the state and national levels. And so they recognized that they had to do something right away. Sorry.
Oh,
so
okay.
They put in this investment, made this decision to do the cleanup and to actually protect the river from further damage from their property. It's great that they did that, but it's important to recognize that they did it to protect themselves from lawsuits and to protect themselves from enforcement action.
So we have two kind of forces here. We have just the law, the EPA, we have the state attorney general, and we have the pressure from the people. Didn't mean to cut you off there, but we have a call from Arthur.
Mm-hmm. All right. Hi. Hello.
Hi.
Hi, Arthur.
A few years back, went to a festival at Cathedral Park, you know, underneath St. John's Bridge. Beautiful day, music festival, lots of people in the water. So I went out to take my toes in it, and it just felt like really kind of oily sand, mud. Like, it wasn't good mud. So I didn't, I'd like to have that question answered, whether it is safe to wade in the mud there.
Hmm.
Yeah. Well, I'd say there are some areas.
Thank you, Arthur.
Yeah, there are some areas of the Willamette River where it's still good to avoid being on the beach and being there. there's, for example, Willamette Cove, which is a site that was bought by Metro, is now owned by Metro. The long-term plan for that Metro was to turn that in, is to turn that into a natural area and park space. But the beach at Willamette Cove is still pretty heavily contaminated with some contaminants that you don't want to be, walking in and getting all over you. And so there's been a lot of action done on that, some cleanup action done on that this year. So that hopefully will be better, very soon, or maybe even it's, I'm not certain if the, if all the cleanup has been done there at this point yet.
It's upland.
But that's an area where Willamette Cove was a site that actually put up signs to tell people, please do not walk on this, be careful, this is a contaminated site. Now, Cathedral Park is just downriver from Willamette Cove, so there's some concern about material that has transported down to that area. As far as I know, Cathedral Park is okay for, just going there, walking on the beach, being there in the, stepping in the water. You're not going to be getting sick or, getting problems just from incidentally being on the beach there at Cathedral Park. There are a couple other sites along the river that are, actually more industrial sites where people generally don't go to on a regular basis, but that you wouldn't want to. And that was something several years ago when a recreational study was done of the Willamette River and try to determine, is it safe for people to be involved in recreation along the river? The study overall concluded, yes, it's safe. There's the water's clean enough. There's no real danger from being contaminated from material along the river for just incidentally swimming or wading in the water. It's fine. You can go ahead and swim. It's not perfect, but it's certainly not immediately dangerous to you. But when they did the study, they excluded certain sites because they said, well, those areas are not accessible, and so people won't go there. They forgot when they initially did the study that a lot of people go out in canoes and go out in boats, and so they land on a beach somewhere, and that beach might be a spot that they considered inaccessible and people wouldn't go there. So we pointed that out to them in the community advisory group. We pointed out that they really need to look at those sites as well because people will go to places that they're not supposed to go to.
All right.
Or people will land on a beach from a boat or from a canoe or from a kayak. And so you need to look at those sites to make sure that those are safe.
Yeah.
There were certain other sites along the river that were identified as, well, these areas are contaminated. You really should not go there.
So I hope that answers your question. Some places are a little, are good to avoid, and other places are somewhat safer.
Yeah. And generally speaking, the sites that have public access that are a beach, a boat ramp or a beach access from a park, those are pretty good. You shouldn't have problems there. It's not something to be overly concerned about. It's just some of the more industrial areas that you might not want to be on the beach in front of Arkema or in front of one of the big industrial sites on the river.
Oh yeah, and I'll just point out that the DEQ, the state DEQ, has an excellent map that has names with a sort of a relative color coding of how much the site has been cleaned up and what needs to happen. We have another call. It's Steve. Hi, Steve.
Hello. I have a question that I've wondered about for a number of years concerning polluted water and the warning on eating fish from those waters. What would happen if somebody caught fish that are in an area where you're really not supposed to eat the fish, and then took one or more of the polluting companies to small claims court for what it would cost to buy that amount of fish.
I don't know.
Showing that you were personally harmed by the pollution.
Would you like be suing for damages if you became ill, or just for the price?
Just for the fact that you are not supposed to eat the fish, but you would like to eat fish. So what would it cost to go to the market to buy that fish?
Yeah, it'd be the damages for the loss of the use of that fish that you caught.
Excellent.
Yeah, I don't think anybody has attempted that or, tried to be a novel approach.
That would be
interesting if a lot of people did that all of a sudden. And
yeah, that would be a way for a person to show that they were personally being harmed. And like you said, if enough people started to do that, especially in small claims court, where my understanding is there's real restrictions on lawyers and such, that it would start to get companies' attention.
I like it.
Yeah.
A
big part of the problem that you'd run into would be figuring out who exactly to sue. Because in some areas of the river, you can recognize, for example, near the railroad bridge, if you catch a fish there that's contaminated with DDT, it's easy to recognize that Arkema, who is the owner of the property that contaminated the river with DDT, would be the company to sue over that.
Well,
when you catch fish at Cathedral Park and it's contaminated with PCBs,
I would think that any of the polluting companies upstream from where you caught the fish could be held responsible because their pollutants are going to be carried downstream. And yes, you said that there's a list of potentially liable companies, and that list, if you knew...
Right, they'd have to... The burden of proof would be on them to prove that they didn't poison the fish, right?
Right.
Okay, hey, we're totally almost out of time, and I just thank you so much for that suggestion, Steve, and I just want to tell you and everybody else that there is a EPA-sponsored information session tonight at ERCO. ERCO is out on, it's the Immigrant and Refugee.
Gleason, 103rd and Gleason.
Yeah, and so that's from 6:30 until 8 tonight, and it's a very informative presentation put on by the EPA, and you can ask the EPA questions directly there. And also, the Portland Harbor Community Advisory Group is doing a community forum, the River for All. Yeah?
On the 29th, 7 p.m., and that's at Immaculate Heart Catholic Church, which is 2910 North Williams Avenue.
Yes, and I think there will be food and drink, is what I read. And there'll be some very interesting, I love how the Portland Harbor CAG always gets community members involved, and you'll always hear a story from somebody who grew up swimming and fishing and using the river, and how things have changed. So it's a very nice, informative and heartfelt thing to attend, in my experience, at the community forums.
And these events are posted on the calendar at the CAG website. So it's portlandharborcag.info. And in the upper left corner of the website is a calendar of upcoming events. And that's a Google calendar. So anybody that uses Google calendar could just add that to the calendars that you view on your own calendar and you'd see it.
Yeah. So, I also, if you go to the EPA's website, I'll have that up on the KBOO page. And the Portland Harbor Community Action Group's webpage is a really nice, easy to use web page. It's very, you can totally find your way down a rabbit hole on the EPA website, but the CAG one is very easy to read and very easy to use, and it's got a nice informative map right on the front page, and it's a great resource. And if you didn't catch it, it'll be up on the KBOO website at kboo.fm/political perspectives. And my name is Kristen Yount. I want to thank my guest, Jim Robinson, again. Thank you so much for taking the time. And
thank you for doing this.
Yeah, it's been my pleasure. Also, public comment period is coming up. So once the decision is made by the EPA, which course of action, they do look for community and individual feedback. So please stay tuned. Watch this space for information about how to make your public comment. And you can also find that information through the websites we talked about. So thanks. When a black cat crosses my path, a woman in the moon is singing to the air. And it is just a few minutes, actually, it's just a few seconds before 10 a.m. And Chris Andre with Air Cascadia. So you're going to want to stay tuned for that. Followed by at 10:15 by Flashpoints. Today, Flashpoints looks at forward policy issues in the presidential campaign. And at 11 on the Recovery Zone, Stephanie Potter interviews Jordan Fink, founder of World Tree, about working with nature to remove carbon dioxide from the atmosphere and into soil. Thanks, KBOO members, for your generous support. Not a current member? You can become one. Go to kboo.fm and click on Donate Today.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Tim DeChristopher Lecture, Wielding the Power of Vulnerability, Thursday, April 7th at 7 p.m. at the First Unitarian Church in Portland. Tim DeChristopher, as Bitter 70, disrupted a Bureau of Land Management oil and gas auction in 2008 by outbidding oil companies for land parcels around Arches and Canyonlands National Parks in Utah. His actions led